Hi, everyone, and welcome to Sped Homeschool Conversations. We are so happy that you're here with us tonight. We do this broadcast every Tuesday night and focus on a different topic every month. This month is foster care and adoption. And so all of our conversations have been focused around that topic. And tonight, our conversation specifically is how to connect with your foster adoptive kids to help them learn and grow. And our special guest tonight is Ethan Demme. Thank you for joining us tonight, Ethan.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are welcome. I'm so excited to have our audience just learn what you've learned and just get to know maybe how to connect with the kids that they have in their home that they have brought in as orphans and made part of their family. And that's exciting. And I thought we would start out our conversation by having you share just a bit about your family and why this topic is so near and dear to your heart.
Well, sure. So a little bit about my background and my wife's background, because it takes a team to do this. So we are both some of those weird homeschool kids. We are both homeschooled all the way through. So we're obviously unsocialized and can't, you know,
right,
talk to the adults very well. But we both came from unique families, and that sort of led us on our journey. She comes from a family of nine. I come from a family of four. Both of us have siblings that have various learning disabilities and special needs. And then that led her, my wife became a teacher when she went to school, and then she became a music teacher. So she has an education background. I call her the kid whisperer, because she can, any kid anywhere, they just run to her.
Oh, that's
at the
awesome.
Playground, and they become best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and after college joined the family business, which was Matthew C at the time, and then now is Demme Learning.
Yes.
So definitely a passion for building lifelong learners and encouraging parents to teach their kids at home. So that's what I've been doing since 2006, so for quite a while. And Demme Learning has been around for 30 years since my parents founded it. To help
right.
other
I'm
going to
put your website up here if anybody doesn't know about Demme Learning. That's probably few and far between, but.
Yeah. So learning and education is sort of in our blood. And then since we got married, we took in quite a few years ago, her youngest sibling. So we've raised a 15-year-old. So I've dealt with teenagers. And then recently we started doing foster care. And so we've had one sort of emergency respite placement. And then for the last 13 months, we had three boys with us. So we had a placement of three brothers, four, five, and six, that became five, six, and seven.
Right. That happens. Yeah,
the last 13 months were pretty crazy, but they were reunified couple weeks ago. So that chapter is sort of on pause or ended for right now. So right now we're back to being an empty nest again.
Wow. Well, that's quite a story. I mean, that's not usually how most people started their marriages, with a teenager. But yeah,
we just do everything backwards.
Yeah, exactly. But is that what opened your just kind of your idea of maybe taking in foster children from there and opening your home to?
Yeah, it's always been on our hearts. I know my wife, ever since she was a young girl, she was at church and heard someone talk about orphans in Russia. And so she's always had a heart for taking care in some way, helping orphans out. We've actually supported a ministry out in Russia, and even visited and gone over and helped work with the kids over there in St. Petersburg. So it's sort of been an ongoing theme. And then we were about to start the foster journey a few years ago when her brother came to live with us. So we put that on pause and said, oh, it'll be different. It's just a sort of a family member coming to live with us. And no, that's pretty much the same thing as foster care.
Yes, exactly. You still have to be the parent, and it's not just a sibling relationship. I know.
I sent you a message.
Yeah,
it's all the same issues.
Exactly. Yes, definitely. So we're going to talk tonight about connecting with foster kids and adoptive kids so that they can learn. And I also want our audience to know, as you're watching with us, if you have questions or comments, definitely put those in the feed. We'll build those into our conversation. We are in English. I know last week we had somebody talking in Spanish. I don't speak enough Spanish to interpret this, so I'm sorry about that. But we hope that if you're joining us and you do have comments or questions, that you'll put those in so we can build them in, and we can ask those to Ethan and make them part of this broadcast. So, but connecting with kids, you know, that what do we as parents who are looking at adoptive foster care, or maybe we're already in that, a parent's in that, and they're kind of struggling. What advice do you have for them about what do you prioritize? How do you set yourself in the right place to make those connections happen?
Yeah, so I think the priorities are sort of the biggest thing. My wife and I were actually talking about this last night, sort of as I'm prepping up. I stole a bunch of her notes. She's working on a blog post on this. She's a good writer. So I copied her homework. We were talking through and wrestling with this, and the priorities are the key, because when you've got kids coming into your home from various backgrounds and with various amounts of trauma, Every choice you make is choosing between which good thing you're going to do, and you have to not do something good. So there's not enough time in a day to do all the things that need to be done, especially when you have kids with developmental delays and you have to go back and rebuild things. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of that is there's no way that you can give it 100% and still keep yourselves healthy. So it's prioritizing both your own self-care, knowing your own limits and boundaries, and then setting priorities for both yourselves as well as for your kids.
So important, because I was down to 2 hours a night of sleep when we had our 3 foster kids, and that was not healthy. You just can't do it for a long period of time.
There's a mountain you can run on, and then the adrenaline starts to run out, and then you just crash and burn. And I think every foster parent's been there, and we all learned that one the hard way.
I think so. Definitely.
So knowing that, so for example, my wife knows that she is an introvert. She needs a lot of alone time. So for her to be a good mom, she needs to spend time being alone, which is hard to do with 3 kids in the house. Yes, and I know that I need sort of physical activity. I need to go out and exercise, ride my bike, run, or build something. So finding time to get those things done and still give the other person enough time and knowing when to call for help and say, you know what, I need to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you take them for the next little bit and vice versa. So that communication is key. And then when you're approaching your family and your foster care or your adoptive journey, that setting your own family rules and priorities. So for us, sort of our big 3, and I'll be coming through these multiple times, is safety is our number one. The kids need to feel safe. It's not enough for them to just be safe. They have to develop that feeling of safety.
Right. Because most of them do not have that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next one is to feel loved. Learning to feel loved is a journey. And then the third step we have is learning to become self-reliant. And a key piece of self-reliance is also to develop empathy. Learning to feel other people's emotions. So those are sort of our big 3. And then we prioritize everything around that. So that's sort of one of the big things. I know we're talking about learning, but one of the key pieces as you dig into helping kids learn, there may be a spelling test tomorrow morning and you're trying to drill the spelling words that they need to know. If they don't feel safe or loved, they're not going to do well on the test.
Right. And that's that whole key component that we kind of started. And the title of this conversation is connecting, because that connection provides that safe, you know, that anxiety doesn't allow them to learn, because when you're anxious, you just can't calm your inside enough to let learning happen. So definitely I can see how all those things play into that process.
Yeah. And then another thing, when you start to go with the priorities, is once you've set your big priorities, you have to sort of let the other things go. And every family is going to be different. Every kid's going to be different. Some simple examples we used in our house were no shoes in the house, because we had three kids that were very scattered with ADD, and if you be everywhere, so we knew they were in the giant messy pile by the front door. Getting on the kids in time still was a struggle at times.
Right.
So we always tried to get places on time, and we were willing to cut corners to do that. So shoes weren't on the right feet all the time. You made the socks never matched, but at least we were out the door. Basic safety. Another one was, we found it was easier and the kids liked it, we just get them dressed the night before for school. So if we got up late, didn't have time to do everything, the clothes are wrinkled, but they're on the bus on time, or they're out the door on time.
My 22-year-old still does that.
Well, hey, if
it works and you don't care if your clothes are wrinkled. Exactly. Might not work too well when he gets his first engineering job next in the summer. So, but I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, you have to let some things drop.
Letting those things go. Yeah, because it's not going to look perfect. And you have to give those things up, because, like, again, you said, those things that you have prioritized, those are the things that are non-negotiables, and everything else fits in somewhere and wherever it can fit usually. So how did you deal with being flexible? I mean, are you pretty much a flexible person? Is your wife kind of flexible, or was that kind of a hard thing to kind of get to that point with?
We're both sort of different. So we're flexible generally, but she's definitely much more naturally structured than I am. I'm the spontaneous one that says, hey, let's just go do this. So we both had to learn to adapt to different ways. So, so being flexible on anything that's not a priority. So for the things that were a priority, you had to sort of stick to those. And that was where you were a team, and we both have to have the same answers for those things. Outside of that, it was learning. So my wife always was looking for a way to say yes. But also another one is, the kids always ask crazy questions and if you say maybe or let me think about that, you actually have to think about it and sometimes say yes. But you also have to look for places where you have to, you know, draw a hard line. And that's where I struggled more, as someone who's like, we can wing it. I like to wing things. Knowing that the kids need the structure more than I need the structure means that I have to be more structured. So sometimes I have to say no to something that I actually think is perfectly fine and I think would be fun to do, but I know they need to hear no at that point. So when you say no, you have to stick to it. So once you draw that line, you have to stick to it. So never draw a line that you're not willing to go all the way on, because they will test the boundaries and say, all right, well, how much are you willing to fight over this one? So choose your battles wisely.
That's very good advice. Yes. So let's talk a little bit about traumatized kids, because if you've never parented a traumatized child, that whole, everything about that safety component is so important. And how do you, as a parent, build that structure in a home to start giving them the feeling of safety, even when they still are trying to cope with what even being in a safe environment is? I mean, the kids that came into my home were in a meth home for 2 years, in a meth house, and they had no idea what safe space was. It was scary most of the time for them. And creating that environment was very difficult.
Yeah, often if you've got, I try to explain it to parents who haven't dealt with kids in care, and I always say, take your instincts and do the opposite. So it's sort of opposite days. So for kids who have had a traumatic experience or a traumatic background, that's normal. So when you put them into what you consider to be a safe environment, that's scary and brand new and just is very scary. So putting them into a safe place actually feels scary to them. So it's about easing into that. So setting up basic routines, you don't have to micromanage every minute of every day, but having some basic, you know, morning routines, bedtime routines, talking through what's going to happen next over and over and over again. So the more you can sort of say, all right, so before we're going to go to school, so I need you to get up and then we're going to get our clothes on and then we're going to go eat breakfast and then we're going to go brush our teeth and then we're going to make our bed and then we're going to go get in the car and then we're going to go to school and then you're going to have a good day at school and then I'm going to pick you up. And repeating that in a morning three or four times for each kid sometimes is what it needs to be. So having that routine from day one to start to set those basic boundaries of here's what we do next. And then there's little things, especially with kids who don't remember what you tell them, because you can say things over and over again. But we had a calendar. We had a calendar in their bedroom. We had a calendar in the living room and the kitchen. And then we would draw pictures on the calendar of what's coming next.
That's good. Yeah, visual schedules.
We had sequenced sort of chore charts. And they weren't complicated chores. It was make bed. And you make the bed as best as you can.
Yes.
Because no one's ever taught you how to make a bed. And it's brush your teeth. And so it's basic things like that. It's maybe three things to do in the morning, three things to do after school, and then two things by bedtime. So it's not a whole lot of stuff, but it's something that they can then, they love checking off the boxes as they go through those things. And then when they come in, but then you start to slowly build those. Once they start realizing there is a routine and they forget what's next, they go, what do I do next? And then you can say, well, why don't you go look at the calendar, look at the chart, and they start to find their own answers to things. But that consistency can be as an adult, especially as one who doesn't like consistency myself. kind of a pain. But if you come from a place where you've never had any consistency, you're retraining their brains to learn that that's safe. And it takes months sometimes or longer to get to that point where they know that that's consistent and safe. And they're going to have meltdowns and tantrums and test the boundaries sometimes 15 times in a day. And you just have to maintain that steady, calm consistency. And when you're unable to, that's when you tap out and you call your spouse and they take over. There's been plenty of times where either myself or my wife has literally tapped out, like, switch, I'll take that one, you take this
exactly.
And then a fresh face can come in and go and offer that empathy when you've about had it. And sometimes too, especially if you have kids who are going back and forth in and out of, like, they're doing visits with their parents.
That's really hard. Yes.
They get to the point where they crave the consistency so much, they'll come back from a visit, at least in our experience, and they'll do what they know they shouldn't do to force you to intervene, to set the boundary again, because they want to feel safe.
Right. Which again is that flipped upside down what we would think, you know, the safety is. I act out and then how do you respond? You know, and it's, am I safe when I do this is what I found. And my dad even said it. I interviewed my parents. My parents have adopted 10. And he said, whenever the kids that say, do you love me? What they're really saying is, or what they're saying when they say, I love you, they're asking, do you love me? Because it, to them, it is, it's flipped because they don't understand what safety is, what love is, all those things. So it's what you are exhibiting when I don't exhibit what this is, when I'm not safe, when I'm not feeling loved.
Yeah. When they're expressing any emotion and you're able to still love them and not scream at them when they're exhibiting emotions, that makes them feel safe. So it's one of, and if they crave that, they know that the only response is, I got to do something bad so that I can feel loved again, because they're just learning to know what that feeling is. And so everything's flipped. It's backwards world.
Yeah. It takes a little bit of your mind growing up in a, what we call, you know, a typical normal house, to wrap yourself around that. And yeah, definitely. What about food?
That one is, so in the safety world, especially kids who have come from traumatic backgrounds, even my brother-in-law who came to live with us, this was a thing for him. And so this has sort of been a consistent big one. I never even thought about it because, again, I came from a safe home where I never worried about the fact that I was not going to eat today. So if kids have come from a place where they don't literally feel safe, food becomes way more than just something you put in your mouth, you chew up and you swallow. It is its own thing. So that connection to feeling loved and safe or feeling in control means knowing that there's food to eat. Those kids will sometimes hoard food or take it to their bedroom.
Mm-hmm. Under their mattress. That's where we had one hide.
Yep. Handfuls of food. They're afraid to leave the table because their brother might steal their food. So you have to say, it's okay. We'll watch your food. It'll be safe. No one's going to take it. There's a big bowl left over. There's as much as you want. Mm-hmm. They'll take seconds and thirds and then not eat it. And that's okay. So letting those things go, but also getting to know them and knowing in their limited background and experience, what are the favorite foods that when they got those, they felt safe. Yeah. So oftentimes they've got very strong connections to certain foods, and those foods tend to be junk food. It's peanut butter and jelly, Cheez-Its, pizza, cheese pizza, nothing fancy on it. It's super, it's Lunchables. Because those are the foods that at some point in their past, someone gave it to them and they felt loved and connected with that. So we sort of had a thing of, which we learned in our training, it wasn't our idea. Most of our ideas we learned from somebody else.
And that's, it's so important as doing foster and adoptive care to do those classes, because you do learn a lot about yourself and you learn these skills that will equip you, definitely.
Yeah. So we always had a snack drawer and that snack drawer mattered. I mean, there were times we're doing homework and nothing's happening and the kids are melting down and we just take a break and say, you know, do you need a snack? Mm-hmm. And one granola bar later and all of a sudden math is so much easier. Right. And the granola bars open and one bite was taken, but nothing else was eaten. Exactly. But it's sitting there right beside them. So that little thing, that connection of safety allowed them to sort of reset and be able to do homework.
Right. We were so glad to have chickens. They ate all the leftovers. We got eggs from it at least.
Yeah. We composted. And another way, like now, if you have a limited food experience, you also don't like fancy new foods. Or spicy foods. So one of the ways we tricked the kids into like, we had a garden and we had them plant the seeds. So we actually built the garden. They dug it out. They planted the seeds. They watched it grow. And then so it took quite a few months, but by the end, they're out there eating all the beans right off the stalk. And like when we got them, they would never eat green beans to save their lives, no matter how you cooked it. But by the summer, when they planted it and they saw it grow, they're eating them raw by the handful. Yeah. Or if we said, hey, you grew this tomato. Oh, well, maybe I'll try it. Even though they said, I hate tomatoes up until that point.
Right. Yeah. Well,
so again, connecting
connecting them again in a safe environment where they're actually learning that this is how food is supposed to be dealt with, instead of making it a safety mechanism or a comfort item. So yeah, that's good. You're going to talk a little bit about empathy as well and the importance of that.
Yeah, so empathy is sort of a big piece. So you've got the safety piece and you've got the feeling loved piece, which is a whole thing in of itself. But as you build that self-reliance, one of the key pieces which kids, especially with traumatic backgrounds, struggle with is seeing emotions in other people. So that empathy is one of those big pieces that's difficult to develop.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes. So we did a lot of work, and some worked and some didn't, or it worked with different kids. So finding what works mm-hmm. for each kid is different. We did a whole bunch of little things. One of the things we did was we, of course, had animals. Having a dog, and our dog is the best dog in the world, which we had actually bought when we got the dog when our brother-in-law came to live with us. Mm. And we actually essentially trained him as a therapy dog. So she is really great with kids. So she's at the point where in the morning when the kids get up, she will literally walk to the bed of the child that's going to have the worst day and just sit there. Aww. So she walks in, the one kid was like, uh-oh, someone's going to have a rough day. And it is. And she was 100% accurate. But after a meltdown or a tantrum, she would come into the room and the child's crying and she would just start licking their face. So, but it's also one, whether it's an animal or a stuffed animal. Another one is you'll have kids who come and they'll attach to a stuffed animal. So, one of the ways to develop empathy is take whatever the child is connected to. They may not have a strong connection to you yet. But they love their stuffed rabbit. And so one of the ways we modeled emotions was you would talk to the child's emotions through the rabbit. So they would hold the rabbit and they would say, you would ask them, oh man, I think that rabbit really loves you. She loves it when you hug him so tightly.
Yeah.
And I think the rabbit's really proud of you. You had a really good day at school. That must make you feel really good. And if you just went directly and talked to the child and said, I think you had a good day at school today, you must feel really good, they might shut down. And I've seen that happen. Mm-hmm. But
that's a little too direct for them.
But the rabbit is their rabbit. They love their rabbit. They sleep with the rabbit. So the rabbit can tell them all those things. So we've had lots of conversations through stuffed animals. And then the other one is just modeling emotions. So oftentimes you sort of stop after they do something and you say, all right, well, if someone did that to you, how would that make you feel? Mm-hmm. We used the little magnets on our refrigerator that had all the different emotion faces on them. Mm-hmm. And we'd talk about, you know, which ones do you feel today? And they would play those games. But there's lots of little things that you just identify when you're reading a book. Mm-hmm. Look at the child's face in the book or the drawing and say, what do you think they're thinking right now? What do you think they're feeling? Are they feeling mad? Are they feeling happy? Mm-hmm. Learning to identify what things are going on in their bodies and then starting to see those things in other people. So putting your hand on their chest and saying, do you feel your heart beating fast if they're really scared or you're worked up, and take some deep breaths. Now put your hand on my heart. How am I beating? Am I beating fast or slow? Mm-hmm. How do I look? Do I look like I'm calm or that I'm mad? Now, it helps if you're calm at that point.
Right. Don't do it when you're upset with them.
Exactly. But those are ways that you can sort of help them identify, this is how my body feels. This is how it's making me feel. And the biggest thing when they're learning to develop that empathy, so the first key stage of empathy for others is empathy for yourself. So if you can't identify your own emotions, you can't identify someone else's emotions. If you can't learn that it's okay to have emotions, so that's one of the big pieces. So we always said it's okay to feel mad. Mm-hmm. It's okay to feel frustrated, but it's not okay to hit your brother with a rock.
Right.
Those are two things. And you're not a bad person because you hit your brother with a rock. You just made a bad choice because you were feeling bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, disassociating those types of things. But I do, you pointed out, you know, the stories, the ways to point out in other people so they can see it. Because oftentimes when we see it in other people, we identify it then with ourselves. It's kind of this mirror effect that it takes the weight off of them too. Because they're thinking, oh, they're just judging me. But if we look at somebody else and say, well, do you often feel that way? Or like the character in the story. And because we used to do read out louds a lot. And our foster kids would really get engrossed. I mean, at age 2 and 3 in these read out louds of novels, because they identified with these characters and the hard places they were in. And we talk about those things. So, Definitely. Yeah.
Reading books was sort of, we spent more time. And then there are certain books that all of a sudden that become a connection point for the child, and then they want to read it, you know, all the time. And you just read it over and over again until sometimes you just have to lose it accidentally.
I did that with my own kids.
Yep. So helping them learn those things, and then like they are going to have tantrums and do bad things. But learning to say, all right, once they're calm, forgive them and let it go. And then, but the other piece of that is there's the forgiveness, and then there's the, all right, you're forgiven, you're good, but now can we do something to make it right? We can't always fix it, but we can do something, some gesture to make it right.
Right.
And then have them, what do you think, if someone had done that to you, what would you want them to do back? Mm-hmm. Well, I'd want them to give me a hug. All right, well, why don't you go give your brother a hug? Mm-hmm. So it's always amazing the creativity that kids will come up with what they would like someone to do to make it right. Mm-hmm. And it's often way better than I could think of. So I just let them come up with it.
Yeah. We used to call it a re-honor job. You have dishonored this person, and now how would you like to re-honor them?
Oh, that's good.
Because asking for forgiveness just gets way too easy. And when you have to actually do something physically, it connects you with that void that you created when you did something against that person. So, yeah. So what about things parents can do to just make that connection with kids that probably have never really known what real love is, to start teaching them that concept of this is what it means to be loved. This is how love is expressed in a good environment and through a relationship that's healthy.
Yeah. So feeling loved is sort of one of those ones if you have to really dig into and try to understand where that individual child is, because each kid's going to be very different. And they're different for very different reasons. So you have the hugger who just day one, they just want to give you a big hug and you think, oh, that's great. But then you dig into it and they don't understand what that means. And then you have the one that don't touch me at all. And so learning with each one what that is. So one of the sort of the key first steps is developing that healthy eye contact. We read a lot of Karen Purvis's books, The Connected Child, and eye contact is one of those things. So dropping to their level and starting with not just staring into their eyes.
Yeah. That can freak you out.
A quick glance of, oh, let me see your eyes. Oh, you have such great eyes. And then move on. So just little quick connections. Because when you look someone in the eye, you have that connection. And think about like someone that you really love, the person you love the most, you can stare into their eyes the longest. But you have to start with those little eye-to-eye connections. And it can just be a glance or just a little, oh, you're such a good boy. For no reason. Like the little no reason things. And then I would call it the appropriate touch of, find out where your child is with touch, because touch is one of those ways, but they may have a very traumatic experience with touch, or they may love touch. So I would sort of take it one step above what they naturally do. Don't go from, I want to shake your hand, to let's give you a bear hug. Take your hand and then put your other hand on top of it and hold it for another 2 seconds. So it's a lot of mirroring. So you're mirroring those things. And then also the same thing you're using to do to connect with your kids to show them that you love them is what you do to your spouse. So if you say to your kids, oh, you're doing great. Oh, you're such a good boy. You look really happy right now. So use the same language to your spouse. If you're wanting to give them a hug, give your wife or your husband a random hug in front of them. So modeling, here's what natural, good human love looks like between two healthy people is a great way. And then, so all of those things are just take the smallest connection that's there and try to do one step more. Yeah. You don't have to go all the way to deep love. You just have to go to one level of connection more and then it's that slow repetition and the consistency every single day.
Yeah. I think oftentimes we go into these relationships thinking that these kids just need lots of love. And the more we can pour on them, then, you know, we'll just make them feel better. But that actually creates bigger walls, just for the reasons that you were talking about. It's not a comfortable place for them. And to take those baby steps to get that. And sometimes they will want to be hugged, but they don't understand it, like you said. And just getting them to the point of understanding their appropriateness of touch as well.
I like to think of it as, because we have a garden and I like to grow things. When you transplant like a seedling out into your garden, you don't just dump water on it.
Right.
Fertilizer. Don't pile it up with fertilizer and say, all right, you have all the good stuff now, thrive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to start with what's the right amount for that plant right now. Mm-hmm. And eventually it gets to where it can grow and then you can put as much water and fertilizer on it. Well, not as much fertilizer, but enough water to where it can grow. As it gets bigger, it can take more.
Right.
So that's sort of how I see it, is they come sort of as a shriveled plant that needs water, but you can't give them too much or it'll drown them.
Right. Yeah.
Which again goes against your instincts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So self-reliance, I guess that is something that, well, unfortunately, some kids that are come out of the foster system have learned to be self-reliant, but not in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. They are just abandoned or made to fend for themselves. And so how do you build a healthy self-reliance, but also reliance on others at the same time? I mean, because that's really what you almost have to do both with kids that have been traumatized. It's kind of a hard mix.
So again, that's another one of those tricky ones. And once you sort of start to get into building those self-reliant skills, and it's a varying amount of skills, you can't do that until they feel safe. So it's again, one of those ones of this sort of the safety is the underlying thing. Because oftentimes the survival skills that the kids come with have to do more with safety than anything else. So they may be super self-reliant when they're in survival mode. Mm-hmm. But once they get into safety mode, they're going to act completely different. One of our boys, when he was being shuffled from house to house, one of the people we picked him up from said, oh, he's the one who's in charge. You can just tell him he'll want to do. He'll tell his brothers what to do. He's great. He does whatever he's told. And we're like, oh, that's cool. Once he started feeling safe, we had to tell him you don't have to take care of everyone else now. It's our job to keep you safe. You have to learn to be a kid. You have to learn to play. So for him, self-reliance was, I can learn to not be on guard and try to keep everyone safe. I can just focus on me. And so he then completely switched. So when, from what he was sort of in the first couple weeks, a very completely different person. His real personality started to come out. So once you get to that point, then you can start to build sort of life skills of self-reliance, of learning to brush your teeth. And it starts with brushing their teeth.
Right.
And brushing their teeth and saying, here's how I brush my teeth. Now I'm going to brush your teeth. And here's why I have to brush your teeth. Why don't you try it? And now I'll spot check you. And then it might take you 6 months and then they can finally start to brush their teeth on their own, which was our case. I mean, you may be six, but it's still going to take you 6 months to learn how to brush your teeth.
Well, that's a really good point, is that, those kids that are toughened that come in, they are so used to being the savior of others that they don't even know how to care for themselves. I know I saw that with one of my brothers that was adopted at 13. And unfortunately, he graduated from high school and decided that he was then going to go save the world because he hadn't really been taught how to take care of himself. And he had that complex that I'm here to care for others because I survived for so long. And it was a cycle that took a long time for him to break until his 30s. But yeah, that is really difficult. And to just be able to make that switch and to be that one that says it's okay that you don't take care of others now.
And sort of as you build that self-reliance, it's not as much skill building. It's helping let kids learn to develop their own skill set. And so we did a bunch of reading and research on playing. And that's sort of the biggest thing that we found was if you can't play, you can't be self-reliant. There's plenty of adults I know that still don't know how to play. And having kids who are in foster care is a great way to relearn how to play. You get rusty at it because the research will say that the way you learn how to self-regulate your own emotions and learn to then interact with other people, the way kids learn that and develop that is through play with themselves, with their with adult, and with their own age. And they need the mix of all of those things.
Right.
So self-regulation, problem solving, all of those things. Because none of the kids that we've seen in our experience who are in foster care but traumatic backgrounds can go by themselves into another room and play quietly and happily for an hour.
Yes, they can't
do it for 1 minute. And so getting them to that point is a process. So that's sort of like the goal is to get to where you can have self-directed play for a period of time. And again, that takes, and there's two ways you can do that. I've always been a more physical player. There's if you read some of the research, people have different play personalities. My wife is the storyteller. So she likes to have mental play and she comes up with these fantasies and she's great to play with because she comes up with these cool things to do and then you can go do them. And I'm like, all right, let's go build something. Let's go fight something. Let's go hit something.
Right.
But both of those are important for kids to do. So as you get into that, sometimes you have to start with, so you've got your self-directed play and then you've got your guided play. And then you've got your prescribed play is sort of the third piece of that. So sometimes you can start with the higher level. I mean, the more constrained or more parameters. So prescribed play is where you're playing a game. You have rules, you have an objective. And you're playing Candyland and there's a set of rules, there's an objective and you're telling the child what to do and they do it. And oftentimes it takes a lot of prescribed play to get to where you can then do guided play. And guided play could be, all right, we have a bunch of blocks. So prescribed would be if you have a set of blocks or Legos and you're building the thing that's on the box.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you're prescribing, all right, we need get me two big ones and then get a whole bunch of little ones for the walls and then get two to set on top of that. You're prescribing steps. Guided play could be, all right, we've got these things. What could we make with this? What would you like to make?
Right.
What do you think would go on the bottom? What would go next?
And kind of using those questions to lead their thoughts. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when you do prescribed play and then guided play, when you see them playing by themselves or with their brothers, they'll start to use and they'll mimic. So there's a lot of mimicry and copying that goes on until they can get to where you can just have a set of blocks and say, go play with those. One of the techniques we did with this, which also was more of both a good one for the kids as well as a sanity check for us, was we had quiet time. Every day, usually after school at some point. So when they're sort of hyped up, we would take 15 minutes. Everyone took a separate spot and they were able to take toys or books with them. And it was just quiet time. So the only rule was you couldn't talk.
And so
we play some music.
And the safety of you being in the same room, you know, everybody kind of being in that same place. So they weren't alone. And then of course they could kind of mimic you as well because there you are being quiet. And so it gave them that modeling as well in the process.
Yeah. We would sort of have separate rooms, but all the doors were open. So we sort of flip between them to make sure that they could see us and they could come if they needed us for anything. But it was also a way to trick the youngest one who according to him was too old to ever take a nap. So we always picked that he would take his quiet time in the bedroom. And most of the time he'd just fall asleep all on his own.
Yeah.
So his quiet time turned into nap time, and we let him sleep for about an hour.
which was a nice quiet time for you.
Yeah. And then he still and never he said he took naps.
Definitely needed it.
But so over the months, you could see there, you could see the skills of what they did in that play go from mimicking us and how we had played with them to being creative and doing their own thing. And then those actually became coping mechanisms that they would then use when they started to get dysregulated or frustrated or mad. Some of them developed writing and drawing things in a notebook as their way of self-regulating. So they would just take a, and we taught them, as if you're feeling frustrated, it's okay to take a pause and go to another room and do whatever makes you feel calmer. So they just leave and go play with Lego or draw for a few minutes and then come back.
Yeah.
That didn't happen all the time or many of the time, but when it did happen, you went, oh, it's working.
Right. You have to have those little victories. Emily is watching and she said, our son will be formally adopted next week. Yay. He's six and has some pride that comes into play and is a barrier when he is being taught things. Sometimes we have learned to present information in a lighthearted way, but if he doesn't care to learn that day, then we just go on and try again another day. I think humor has a very big place in relating to the kids. And it's something they, a lot of traumatized kids don't even understand, but they click with very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think Emily has sort of one of the big pieces, which is oftentimes we think of, all right, it's time to stop this and do learning. But if something's coming up, either an emotion or a safety thing, or they're just not, it's not clicking, just skip it. It's way more important to try to maintain a healthy connection than it is to try to force learning to happen. Because if the environment's there, the learning will happen. But if it's not, there's nothing you can do that can force it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And it's those connections, as we've been talking, you know, since we started, it's building these safety zones. It's building the empathy, building all these relational things, because without that and without that connection, as we talked about at the very beginning, that anxiety is so high in traumatized kids that your learning just doesn't happen. And so,
it reminds me of a story. I was working on math homework, and of course I'm Mr. Matthewsy, so I get tagged with the math homework. So it was our 7-year-old who was in second grade at the time. So when they came to us, they were definitely well behind grade level. We spent the summer tutoring, spending a lot of time working on place value and things. But then he was struggling with his subtraction problems. So my wife has sort of had it at that point, and she was needed to
tap out. I've tried everything.
And then I said, all right, I'll come in and save the day, Mr. Math Man. And I started to dig into the math homework, and I quickly realized math wasn't the issue that night. So I've tried a couple different reset methods. So the first was, all right, I said, we're going to take a break. We're going to stand up a new jumping jacks. I didn't want to do jumping jacks. And there was definitely some anger in there. We're like 2 days from off of a visit,
That's the whole other component. Yes.
So I could tell he had some anger in there. So I taught him this fun game, which he liked to play. So you hold your hands up, and one person puts their hands on top and you slap the other person. They try to move them out of the way. So I was like, all right, let's play the slap game. And I let him slap me pretty much as hard as he could. And I didn't mind. So we did that for a little bit, and then he started, and he was letting the anger out, which was good. And then it got to a point, then I made a funny face, and then he laughed. And at that point I was like, all right, so now let's take just 10 minutes. We're going to do as much of this math homework as we can. And at the end of 10 minutes, you could be done with one problem or all the problems. It doesn't matter. We're just going to do 10 minutes. So I set a timer. So I was like, it doesn't matter how much you do. We're just going to take this amount of time.
Right.
And then we got the blocks out, because he was using, he had been taught a couple years ago to use touch math, where he's counting all the things, and that was his go-to crutch. So whenever he got stressed, he would go back to touch math, and it was not a good strategy for him. So we pulled out the blocks and he focused, and we were able to get the whole subtraction sheet of homework done, and he got all the problems right, built every single one, and he did it in 9 minutes and 59 seconds, and he came in right on time. So, but it took it took a couple of resets to get to that point.
Right. But you took the time to connect with him and to deal with the underlying issue that he was struggling with that he couldn't even identify. And that's what allowed him to learn.
And then there's other times when, you know, maybe it's the day after a visit or things are just way off. We just say, we're not doing homework tonight. Most parents, I think, should do this, but we definitely did it. Teachers don't always like it, but we just told the teachers, here's what's going on. If they're in a dysregulated space, we're ignoring homework. We're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're advocating for them. I mean, that's...
Yeah, because they're not going to learn anything. So if it's not beneficial for them to learn either the discipline of doing something or the actual work... Mm-hmm. If they're not in that space to learn, then we're not going to try to do it. We're going to spend more time connecting or making them feel, finding out what's making them feel safe. How do we make them feel loved? How do we make them feel connected? And that's way more important and a higher priority than math homework.
Right. Well, they can catch up on those learning things. It's amazing. You know, when you start building those bridges, those relationships, and that safe space, just how quickly when they have those things as their foundation that they can learn, and their brains are ready, and they'll progress at a fast enough rate.
And one of the other sort of key elements that I sort of learned through this process, and play helps you learn this. But a lot of kids that I've dealt with, especially our kids who came from a traumatic background, are scared to death of failing. So the fear of failure is really high.
Because they think that you're not going to love them if they fail.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So teaching them that failure is the only way that you're able to learn is one of those things. And so I spent a lot of time, once I sort of made that, connected those dots, would talk about times in my past where I failed. So you have to tell a story as, oh, when I was your age, I was very bad at reading and I struggled with it, and it made me feel frustrated. But I kept learning, and now I look at all these books I've read. Or when I was learning to swing on a swing set, I fell off and I hurt my back. Sometimes you embellish your tales a little bit to make it sound like you fail even more than you did. But those stories, and sometimes I did this, we had little tangrams, little shapes we would build things with. And so I learned this with one of my kids who was more of a perfectionist. And so we would take turns building one of the shapes. And so what I started to do, once I started to see him get really mad at himself when he would not do it perfectly, is I would do it poorly. I'd get it to where it was relatively close, or I'd color things and I'd go outside the lines and I go, oops. Oh, well, and I'd have them correct it if they felt like it. But I was like, that's good enough. No, that's great. I did it great. So having them see me actually physically do it worse than they can was one of those. It made it safe for them to experiment and try harder ones that were out of their skill set. So failing is one of the, and failing in front of your kids, which is also really easy to do, especially when you're frustrated. So
apologizing. All your buddies and ones you didn't know you had.
And that goes to regulating emotions. If you're having your kids have a tantrum and then they have to apologize and then make it right, sometimes you lose your temper and you yell, and then you have to apologize and then ask them, what can I do to make it right?
Right.
Exactly. And when you do that, it all of a sudden it connects that. So modeling that learning is good, modeling that failure is okay, modeling saying you're sorry, all of those things teach them that those things are good. But again, they can't learn any of those things if they don't feel safe or loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they see that you feel safe and loved when you do those things. And that, you know, people aren't kicking you out of the house when you, you color outside the lines, or, you know, because there's so many fears that they come with and that they bottle up, and they don't even understand that they have them. But exposing them little by little, just by, you know, bringing them out through different scenarios. And like you say, the storytelling we talked about, and the modeling, the role playing, there's just so many different ways that, you can build those connections.
Yep.
So yeah, we just have a few minutes left. Is there anything that you want to add? We've covered a lot of ground already.
Yeah. I don't know. Probably one of the other things, which whether you're, I mean, if you've been in the world long enough, you know, but other folks don't, which I sort of try to explain to them, is the safer the kids feel, the worse they're going to act.
Yeah.
So
yeah, because they're going to test you.
Yeah. When they feel comfortable enough to hit you and scream at you, you know that you've finally made that connection. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, now you also hate it when they're doing that. So getting sort of removing yourself from the situation that's happening right now and looking down and going, well, the reason they're able to kick and scream and throw things and break things is because they know that I'm not going to kick them out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's taken to that point. So oftentimes other people will have, oh, they're so good, they're so well behaved. And I was like,
uh-huh. Uh-huh. They are good when they're outside your house.
But all those things are bottled up. And the minute they come home, they're all coming out.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's the other side of foster and adoptive care that isn't talked about. I think more people are talking about it now. There's just so much that these kids have to deal with, and that you have to walk through with them, because they can't sort it out on their own. They're too young, and they don't understand. Like, your kids were pretty young, right? You said four, five, and six. Five and six. Yeah, ours were 3, 2, and 2. We had twins, and they just have no idea. And they personalize everything that's happened to them. It's me. And you have to pull that apart from who they are to what happened to them. And that can be a lifelong process for them. You know, just growing up in what's, you know, considered a normal environment, we go through things like that. Who am I? And yeah, so it definitely takes.
Yeah, it's one of the ones of, as you dig into it, one of our caseworkers that she was interviewing us basically said, the more you dig into it, the more you're going to start to recognize that there are no normal environments. Mm. Everyone's got a degree of messiness in their life. And the good foster parents are the ones who have at least acknowledged that they're messed up.
Right. It exposes so much in you, and you have to be willing to deal with your stuff as well as theirs.
And you don't have to fix yourself by any means. You just have to know that it's there.
Just deal with it.
Because if you don't acknowledge that it's there, the kids that you take into care will find it in about 30 seconds, and they will take full advantage of you.
Exactly. Yes, they're very good at that. So, well, thank you so much, Ethan. This has been a wonderful conversation. I just want to put Demi Learning's website up. So Demi Learning is... they have Matthew C and Spelling UC, and you have some other small other things. I can't remember exactly all that. You guys definitely have a lot of things, and it's for typical learners, struggling learners, and it's just really good curriculum. Definitely.
And we have a new one that just came out called AIM, or Accelerated Individualized Mastery, which. It's a lot of what I actually did with our boys over the summer. It's a way to sort of supplement whatever's going on in school or with another program. It helps you really develop that full mastery of your addition and subtraction facts. So brand new product just launched last week.
Great. We'll have to make sure we get that into our group, share that information. Emily says, thank you y'all so much. So much good info. Yeah. Definitely. This was a very packed hour, and it's going to be hard picking the little segments that we rebroadcast next week, because you did have so much good stuff to share, and I appreciate you taking the time to touch on those things, because this is a really difficult subject, but we're wanting to support these children and help them to, you know, whether you have them in your home for just like a short time, like you did with the foster care, or, you know, a long time with adoptive care. It's, you know, all the information, all the training you can get as a parent is very important, because it is very, very difficult, but you can do it if you're called to do it and equipped. That's what gets you through. So thanks so much, Ethan, again. And we're going to continue the subject. Yeah. One more week. We got one more week in February. And so Cheryl Swoop, who is the author of Simply Classical, is going to talk to us about adoption, special needs, and homeschooling. I told her we'd make it a really broad topic and we'd cover whatever we didn't cover in the other three broadcasts. So who knows what we're going to talk about. But she's an adoptive mom of two. And so she... And both of her kids are adults now, and they have special needs and live at home. So so she's got a wealth of information to share as well. So we hope you join us back here again next week. So definitely check out Demi Learning and check out our website at spenhomeschool.com. And we'll see you again here next week. So bye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.